Last month, Las Vegas Metro Police introduced a new initiative for curbing gang activity. Police will perform interventions for minors suspected of gang membership by informing their parents. And gang members who are already flagged by Metro now have the opportunity to get themselves removed from the gang's database. So how big a problem are gangs in Las Vegas, and is the gang population expanding? Joining us to talk about Metro's new initiative is Captain Chris Ankeny. He heads Las Vegas Metro's gangs unit. Captain Ankeny, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
One advantage of the new system is that some people who were in Metro's gangs database were not actually gang members. How did that happen?
Well, looking back at our previous policy, it was not specific as far as how to identify a gang member, former gang member, affiliate, and so forth. And so when we took a look at our policy, we wanted to make it more specific and look at the criteria for identifying gang members.
Obviously, it was a problem for people who weren't involved. Did it interfere at all with Metro's efforts to stem gang activity?
No, I don't believe it interfered with our efforts to stem gang activity, but we want to ensure that the information that we have is accurate. And so one of the reasons for looking at our policy was to ensure the accuracy of the information that was coming into the gang unit.
So once a suspected gang member is notified that he or she's in the database, if in fact they're not in a gang, what do they need to do to get themselves removed from the list?
Well, let me start by talking about the policy itself. There's two different parts of the policy. One's for juveniles and the other's for adults. For juveniles, if it's the first time a juvenile has been identified as a gang member or an affiliate, that information will be forwarded to the gang unit. We will then go out, gang detectives, and sometimes one of our prevention specialists will assist, and go out to the residents on the field identification card and make contact with the parents and the suspected gang member or affiliate. The purpose of this is twofold. One, to provide resources to that individual and to the parents, because sometimes the parents aren't aware of their child's activities and so forth, and for awareness and also to prevent further involvement in the gang.
How difficult is it to determine if somebody, an individual, is in a gang or is involved with gang activity?
Well, it's not too difficult. It just requires parents to parent. It requires them to be observant. And,
well, I'm thinking, I guess, more for Metro, for the gangs unit.
Well, there's several criteria, and that was one of the things that we focused on as far as making it more specific. Before, our criteria was gang clothing, location where the individual was stopped, gang tattoos, and so forth. But this wasn't specific information. What we're looking for is the officers to be able to articulate why. Why is it gang paraphernalia? Why is it gang clothing? Why are those gang tattoos? And officers go through a lot of training, not only in the academy itself, but also in-service training after they become regular police officers, to identify these specific traits of gang members.
Now, obviously, anybody you run into can say, well, I'm not in a gang. So how does Metro verify innocence or just non-involvement?
Well, again, the process starts with either a reasonable suspicion stop or a probable cause stop, where a patrol officer or a gang enforcement officer stops an individual that's suspected of being a gang member. That individual, through a series of clues, would then be identified as a gang member based on clothing, based on tattoos, based on the totality of the circumstances. Whereas before, our policy was if there was only two criteria, an individual could have been listed or classified as a gang member. Now, that two criteria, in addition to articulation as to why that criteria is specific to a specific gang.
Mm-hmm. We're also joined by Dr. Georgia Leap. She teaches anthropology at UCLA and has done extensive research on gangs. Dr. Leap, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your work has taken you inside gang culture in Los Angeles primarily, but LA gangs and Las Vegas gangs have some things in common. What are those similarities?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that many gang members from Los Angeles migrate up to Las Vegas in search of business opportunities and also sometimes on the run from the law. What they have in common, of course, is, you know, gang life, gang structure. But in addition to that, you know, they do a very brisk business in drug dealing and distribution and also gun running. And now in recent years, they have also gotten into sex trafficking as well.
Now, Captain Chris Ankeny, how big a problem is it for Metro to have gang members from other cities relocating here?
Oh, it's a huge problem. Not only do they continue their activities now in Las Vegas, but then they compete for specific turf, specific areas to sell narcotics, and they compete with our homegrown gang members, and that becomes a problem in and of itself.
Yeah, so how do you identify newly migrated gang members? Is that tougher to track than gangs who are already established here?
Not really. Again, they have those indicators.
The colors, the tattoos, things of that sort.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the majority of the gang members don't have an issue with flouting that information, being able to they have pride in their gangs and so forth. And so when officers who are trained on how to identify them and talk to them and develop information from them, they're pretty easy to identify.
Now, also joining us on the line from Reno is Roberto Nere. Roberto Nere, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, David.
You were once in a gang. Take us to that moment when you felt that gang life had something to offer you.
Well, you know, I think it has a lot to do with how you live, where you live, and how you grow up. In my case, you know, I wasn't a kid who had issues and wanted to join a gang. I grew up in it. So by the time I was 3, 4, 5 years old, I had already seen a lot of the awful stuff that occurs in the neighborhoods, and one of them is power. My issues when I was growing up, and it still hasn't changed for many of us who are in gangs, is that, you know, people tend to peer pressure you, or you get bullied, or you see certain things that create such psychological impacts that affect you. So you grow up trying to become powerful so that no one ever, you know, gets to hurt you again. And I think that as a result of that, because we're so narrow-minded in the way we think and the fact that we're not able to reach out or have the mentors in place that could help us, guide us in a better direction, we begin doing the stuff that we do.
You said 3, 4, or 5. That's when you began to be aware of it. Well, that's a young and impressionable age.
Yeah, because by the time I was 15, 16, 17, I had already made it a goal of mine to make sure that no one would ever hurt me again. And when you're caught up in that, you know, you don't know nothing else but to stay safe. And sometimes that just takes you into a journey, an unexpected journey, of course, because you're only trying to survive. But the kind of choices and decisions you make afterwards is what makes, you know, the impacts in our lives in terms of, like, either death or incarceration.
Mm. So what led you to decide that gang life was no longer for you? When did you walk away?
I got really tired of being tired, you know, going in and out of jail, hurting my family, wanting a better life for my children, and not knowing where to start. I knew that somehow if I tried or if I didn't give up, I could possibly achieve that. But, you know, trying to get out of it and getting and being successful at it is a totally different thing. It's not easy.
Hmm. And now you have started a group called Guiding a New Generation. It's a group that works with gang members. You counsel these gang members. Do they give some of the same reasons for joining a gang, the stories that are similar to yours?
For the most part. But you know what? We also see a lot of kids that are wannabes that only socialize. They associate with certain gang members because they have nothing better to do. And unfortunately, you know, when it comes to crime and being involved in gangs, when something terrible happens, like let's say a drive-by, and that kid's just hanging out because he doesn't have nothing better to do, then that kid's just going to be charged no differently. And I think that's where the problem comes in with respects to the issues that we're having psychologically, because in my line of work, you know, we know the problems. We know the menace that gangs, you know, cause to our communities. The question is, what are we doing about it? You know, what are we doing to combat it? And I don't know about Las Vegas, even though I work out there also. But in Northern Nevada, very little is done.
We are talking about gang activity in Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas area, and some of the efforts to stem that activity. We are talking with Captain Chris Ankeny, who is the head of the gang units at the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Roberto Nere, who is a former gang member and head of a group working with gang members called Guiding a New Generation. And Georgia Leap. Dr. Leap is an anthropologist and an expert on gangs based at UCLA. George Alip, you told us earlier that one thing that has changed about gang life from when you started doing your research is that gangs are recruiting much younger members. Why is that happening?
You know, it's really supply and demand. And I was so intrigued when the young man said over the phone that he had been aware of this from a very early age. I think it's a combination. I think that younger and younger individuals want to be in gangs because in Los Angeles, this is a cross-generational or intergenerational problem. More kids are sort of growing up with the gang culture in their families and in their communities. The other reason is, you know, naturally juveniles are used by gangs because they will be sentenced under juvenile law, they are not tried or found guilty as adults, and they will often, quote-unquote, get away with more. The younger the child, the more likely they are to get away with things. But most importantly, as families break down, children are affected at younger and younger ages, and this is the real price we're paying for a lack of family structure, a lack of community structure, and this is the fallout from that.
Captain Chris Ankeny, what's the youngest age group you've seen where you have encountered gang members, kids affiliated with gangs?
In their early teens.
Early teens,
yeah.
So 13, 14,
absolutely.
in that range.
Yeah.
Well, Metro is trying to intervene with families of suspected gang members as part of this program. Tell us what you've got to do to keep kids from joining gangs in the first place.
Well, you know, from Metro's perspective, it's a four-step process, really. Four things that we need to do to prevent or at least reduce gang violence. And the first is enforcement. We have to have enforcement. We have to have officers out on the street stopping individuals and preventing them from committing crimes. But more importantly is the prevention intervention aspect. And the Gang Crimes Bureau of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department is highly engaged in this process, as well as reentry. Now, a lot of gang units across the country focus on only enforcement. But I'm sure you've heard this before. You can't arrest our way out of this problem, and we can't. And Dr. David Kennedy had brought that up in his book "Don't Shoot," and we prescribed to that. We subscribed to that philosophy over at Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that we're doing, I know the caller from Reno had said that the communities aren't doing things, but we are here in Las Vegas. Maybe not enough, but we are on that path of providing those resources to these kids and giving them an option rather than gang involvement. That would include, partnerships with outreach programs, providing resources like basketball tournaments and football clinics, just anything that the department can do to get these kids off the street.
Roberto Neri, what are some of the things that police can do if they're not doing enough? Does arresting these kids serve as a deterrent?
You know, we understand that law enforcement has their job to do, like he mentioned, mm-hmm. and that's true. You know, our communities need to be safe. But just like we spend thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, on law enforcement to keep our community safe, I don't think there's enough being done, you know, with respect to funds that can go to providing intervention and prevention. I believe in intervention and prevention because I've lived a life that has taught me the experience and the knowledge to know how to intervene, how to prevent. But, you know, one person can't do it alone. And though we talk about how, yeah, it takes a village to raise a child and we need churches, law enforcement, the community, and other nonprofit organizations behind the prevention effort, you know, it's a tough job. Not anybody can do it, you know, but these kids aren't getting the opportunities or the mentors or the services that they need that we as a community lack for them to be able to become more competitive in a competitive world. They also lack education. They lack unemployment opportunities, you know, and my point is that even though services are, you know, that services exist, very little is being done to build that bridge for them to cross over.
Captain Ankeny, are these some of the populations that are the most vulnerable? The kids where there's not a lot of education, there's not a lot of employment opportunity, things like that?
Absolutely.
Who are the most vulnerable people in Las Vegas?
What we see when we're doing our home visits is children that their parents are either one parent at the house or a guardian, a legal guardian that's watching the kids. The kids are watching themselves. They're watching younger brothers and sisters, there really isn't any parenting involved. Low socioeconomic neighborhoods are usually where we're seeing this problem more predominantly. But again, you know, part of the process that we're going through right now with Metro is collaborating with the community. You know, we're talking about the change in our policy. That was a collaborative effort with individuals that would probably never been involved in a policy change with the police department. We worked together with the ACLU, the NAACP, and other individuals that were have a voice within the community to change our policy, to make it more effective, and to make it more trusting and for people to buy into it.
Dr. George Alip, in your experience, what makes an effective gang intervention program? What are the components?
Well, first of all, I think that there has to be many, many components. There's not just one, and I hate to use this expression, there's not a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. There has to be gang interventionists who work on the street in concert, although they're not informants, but they work in concert with law enforcement to stop shootings, to stop retaliations, as David Kennedy outlined in his book, Don't Shoot, which was excellent, and talked about this kind of street intervention and violence interruption. But beyond that, we have to have a strategy for long-term intervention, getting gang members to see that there is an alternative. And I've worked with several nonprofits. The largest here in Los Angeles is Homeboy Industries, founded by Father Greg Boyle. And this organization offers everything from tattoo removal to counseling to yoga classes to job preparedness, and it has businesses on site that former gang members learn about a different way of life, and then they're ultimately placed in businesses outside in the community. Alongside that, they have mentors who are former gang members who understand what it's like to leave the life and to face real life on your own terms in the truth of your identity. So I think you can tell by my discussion, it's really a multifaceted approach. And yes, I really applaud the folk in Las Vegas, because I think it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a city to help a gang member out of gang life.
So, George Alip, are there interrupters, the former gang members that kind of step into the middle of things and try to cool things down in Las Vegas? Are you aware of that phenomenon here?
I'm not aware of that, but I do think that Las Vegas is certainly a place that wants to try out some innovative strategies, and I think it's very ripe for those. I'm not aware of them, but mm-hmm. I would certainly like to learn about them if that was true.
Yeah. Captain Chris Ankeny, are you aware of that phenomenon here, interrupters?
I'm aware of the phenomenon mm-hmm. of having violence interrupters. They were successful in Boston and successful mm-hmm. in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They have some issues as well.
Yes.
But we do not have a system like that here in Las Vegas. We are working on partnerships with faith-based groups. We have a initiative that we call RECAP, Reclaiming Every Community Around Peace. And the RECAP initiative actually focuses on doing activations, not exactly like they did in Boston or Chicago, but every city is different, and our response is based on our own city. Mm-hmm. But these volunteers actually respond to the scene of a gang-related incident or an incident where there's a possibility of retaliation, and begin not from the police department's direction, but they begin on their own working with the families of the victims and suspects to quell the violence and to prevent that further retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Roberto Nure, help us to understand how that cycle plays out, the cycle of an act of disrespect or an act of violence, retaliation on top of that. How does it play out, and how does it ever end?
Well, we got to remember that these kids are programmed to act and do certain things the way they know how. And respect, obviously, is the only thing that matters to them in their subculture. When up here in Reno and in other places where I've been working closely with, when gang violence occurs, we try to pinpoint the problem and go directly to it. But you can't just go to the neighborhoods or talk to these gang members if you don't have a rapport with them. So it's always helpful to understand who the kids are. And obviously, if you're there to get them and you don't have some sort of rapport with them, they're not going to communicate or talk well with you. But when you do, you're able to walk into some of these neighborhoods, especially if you know certain shot callers or people who play a role in the gang, and you're able to diffuse the situation. For us, it's important because obviously we're tired of seeing kids dying or them going to prison. They don't know any better, and it's hard for us to be able to intervene and then be able to, you know, understand it overnight. But when you're able to intervene and communicate with them, you know, and they allow you to open up, and they open up with what, you know, you're saying, you're able to somehow redirect their actions. And if we can just get them to calm down and let them see that violence isn't the answer, or that, you know, their mom or loved ones are going to hurt based on the decision, then that gives us enough time to, you know, do what we not need to do. And in return, I think that what we get is, you know, no retaliation, less violence, and then we try to approach, you know, whatever tension is occurring in a productive manner by either getting both sides together or hopefully getting them, you know, to agree that what how they're handling this problem isn't right, and then be able to provide options.
So, Georgia Leaf, how do you redirect that mindset that says everything begins with gaining respect? How do you show these young people another way?
Well, I've done a 5-year study at Homeboy, and we've interviewed over 300 people to say, what made you change? Exactly the question that you asked this morning. You cannot force gang members to change. They have to come to that moment themselves. They are often tired of being tired. And we found that there were turning points for gang members: birth of a first child, one of their homies being murdered. The most important thing is that there be something there to catch gang members when they decide to leave the life. The most important, like a place like Homeboy or some of these different agencies that help serve gang members. But on top of that, the most powerful messengers are former gang members that can mentor and serve as guides to gang members who want to leave the life. Gang members not going to listen to me, skinny little white woman, saying, you got to get out of gang life. But they may listen to someone who used to lead that life who's no longer in there.
Are there opportunities in things like having children as these young men become fathers?
Yes.
Does that present an opportunity?
Yes, and let me add to that, young men and young women, because we're seeing increasing numbers of females gang involved. Sometimes it's a first child, sometimes it's a first son, interestingly enough, for men. But I've also heard very tragic stories where a young gang member was sitting next to another young gang member in the back seat of a car, and a bullet came through the back window and killed one of them, and the other one decided, that's it for me.
Roberto Neri, what is the secret to getting gang members out of gangs and keeping them out? Do any of the things that Dr. Leap said about successful intervention ring true in your experience?
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. I mean, I think that in my kind of work, if I wasn't able to at least, you know, make a small difference, even though I care about the situation, I wouldn't be getting anywhere. But what she's saying basically is that, see, we as gang members are helping ourselves by helping others. Gang members helping other gang members. When we reach out and provide hope, we as a community get better. And with me, for example, life is what you do with what happens to you. You know, what I've been through is an opportunity to help other people. And as a result of others relating to what I'm talking about, that's usually half the battle. But, you know, the growth could not have been found without going through my turmoil. Therefore, now I understand, I feel, and sometimes, you know, that helps, especially when you're trying to deal with someone who's deep in it.
Dr. Georgia Leap, your book, you've written a book about all of this, and the title of the book includes the phrase, What Gangs Taught Me. I'm sure it's a bigger answer than we've got time for here, but in a nutshell, what's the most important lesson you have learned from studying gangs?
Wow. That these are incredibly sensitive and intelligent people that, because of their circumstances, have gone down the wrong road. And they need our compassion, they need structure, and they need a real understanding of their lives.
Dr. Georgia Lee is an anthropologist and an expert on gangs at UCLA. She joined us from Los Angeles. Roberto Neri joined us from Reno. He is a former gang member, the founder and head of Guiding a New Generation. It's a group working with young gang members. And Captain Chris Ankeny is the head of the gang unit at the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Thank you all very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. So much.